This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May of 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Stay connected this winter with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month with all-in pricing for 2 years. But that's not all. Your first month is on us. This deal gets better with a free modem and installation, along with free Wi-Fi your way whole home coverage. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and keep all your devices connected and secured with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires March 3rd, 2024. Learn more at Breezeline.com.
There's no place to escape to.
This is the last podcast
on the left.
Live from your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
Man, I can't wait to hit the Tupac part of my career, man.
Oh, yeah?
Just super fucking paranoid, fucking smoking on blizzons all night long. I got a podcast talking about horror movies. One studio I got doing our podcast, Main Live.
Henry, woo! I hate to break it to you. I think you're in the middle of your Tupac phase. That's exactly what you do already. You get stoned every waking second that you're not talking, you're smoking marijuana.
You're amazingly paranoid.
Yeah, dude. Well, you got to be, man. All eyes on me, man. I got eyes in the back of my head. My eyes are on them.
All right. Welcome to the last podcast on the left, everyone. I am Ben Kissel with Marcus Parks here on the East Coast.
That's us.
And then West Coast, Henry Zabrowski.
Can you guys, honestly, you guys can't see me.
Are you trying to make a gang symbol with your fat Polish hands? Because it's really, you can't, it does not look, it looks like the penguin when you do it. You look like Danny DeVito's penguin.
When I do the West Side, I do look like Danny DeVito's penguin. But is this Bloods? This what with the hand with the curls up.
It actually, you have just spelled bread. You just spelled bread with your hands. All right, we are on to part two of Biggie and Tupac. Great reception for the first one.
Yes,
which was so nice to hear. So thank you for all the positive feedback.
Well, I did also get some negative feedback.
Well, there was a small correction that has to be made, but that's okay.
Little correction up top. Puff Daddy was not the son of Frank Lucas. All right. Puffy's dad, Melvin Combs, worked for Frank Lucas and was killed in a drug deal gone bad when Puffy was 3. I made a mistake, okay?
We're out here fucking on the front lines of the podcast wars going on right now. Nobody understands that. We got shots coming our way, so we got to take shots going their way, man, because I am too real to be corrected.
Yes, nothing less physically violent than a podcast feud. We are not exactly none of us are a mobile people. We are sitters.
Is there anything more mentally violent than a 1-star review on iTunes?
All right, let's do this.
So when we last left our protagonists, Suge Knight and Tupac had just made a deal to spring Tupac from jail in exchange for 3 albums on Death Row Records. Mm.
So remember, Tupac came from a world of being like a street poet.
Right.
Thug life was about uniting the gangs. But see, when he came out of jail, his whole shit had changed. He'd become very hardcore.
Right.
Because he saw something in jail that, and it changed him, and he came out swinging hard, and now he is Suge, has his back, and is kind of like making him feel very, very confident. And the two of them are kind of a chicken and the egg scenario of who's making who worse.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, meanwhile, Suge Knight's criminality was only getting bolder. In 1994, Suge allegedly directed his entourage to stomp a Roland 60s Crip to death during a death row party at the El Rey Theater, where we had our Halloween show last year.
No kidding. Wow, I didn't realize that was also the location for a stomp to death.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wild. Do they usually give the directive? I know that there's a lot of directives to harm somebody. I didn't realize they actually articulated it exactly how to do it.
Well, it was just pretty much get him. Okay. Get him and get it. Usually, like, get him in that context means stomp him to death.
So, and of course, stomping someone to death is when you bring a bunch of steel garbage cans together and you got a bunch of broomsticks. It sounds really good.
Yeah.
That's a little you reference
have
to be, stomp.
Because stomp is an hour and 45 minutes
long. Yes.
Then, in 1995, Suge beat and tortured a record promoter named Mark Anthony Bell during a Christmas party at Suge's home. Bell was held captive in a room in Suge's house and was beat senseless by Suge's crew before being allegedly forced to drink Suge's piss from a champagne flute.
Oh my!
Now, honestly, wow. Set the scene, right? Like, music's playing. It's nice little party and stuff. Suge's in the back. He's got a Santa hat on. They're all drinking eggnog. And this is kind of true. They had it. I'm certain they had, like, you know, it had like liquor in it, but it was eggnog.
I think you're kind of Griswolding up the scene here a little bit. Kind of Griswolding it up.
There's a lot of Griswold imagery in this story.
Okay.
So he sees Mark Anthony Bell walks in. They're just like, we got to go. We're going to get him. He's going to bring us to Puffy. They bring him to, which is Suge's main MO, right? Bring him to another location. And what did we learn on our podcast? Never go to a second location.
Never do it.
He said, come, we're going to go talk with you and my boys. We're going to go talk up in my upstairs bedroom. They go in that bedroom. They tie him to a chair. They start wailing on him.
Jesus.
All of a sudden, Suge goes in the room. And now this is according to Suge. After jail, what he said, he's like, yeah, it's like a lot of people say that we tortured Mark Anthony Bell. But actually, I mean, like, all we did was hit him a couple times and make him drink a little pee. That's all we did. And so he went and he filled a champagne flute filled with his own urine, which is difficult. Mm. If anybody's ever been on a road trip and tried to fill a beer bottle with piss, like in the scene from Dumber and Dumber, it's difficult to know the levels. It shows he's done this before.
He's an expert in it. Huh? Oh, right.
Yeah. So, and then they made him drink the pee.
Okay.
Which is just like, that's very humiliating.
I think we could call it torture.
Yeah. Oh, we can definitely call it torture. And the guy himself, he said that he did not drink pee. He tried to jump off the balcony. They did bring out a champagne flute full of piss.
Okay.
And no matter what, everyone agrees that there was a champagne flute full of piss involved near somewhere. But the guy, Mark Anthony Bell, said he tried jumping off the balcony. So he never drank the piss, but they did beat the fuck out of him.
All right. How high up were they there? Third, second floor?
Probably second or third
floor. Okay, so he could have jumped over.
Yeah, and this whole disgusting incident happened because Suge believed that Bell knew who was responsible for the death of a close friend and associate of Suge's, a bodyguard named Jake Robles.
Okay.
3 months before this incident, the Death Row and Big Boy crews had run into each other at the Platinum Club in Atlanta. Before the fight was over and done with, Jake Robles was shot and killed.
Mm.
Now, virtually nothing is known to us as to who the actual culprit was, if it was an order that was given to attack Death Row staff, or if the whole thing was just a simple confrontation that got out of hand, as these things sometimes do.
All right.
But one thing was for sure. The East Coast-West Coast rivalry now officially had a body count.
Also, if you want to count the fact that Suge gave Eazy-E AIDS, slipping him a hypodermic needle when they had that meeting trying to sign, trying to figure out the all the shit with fucking Ruthless Records.
Did that happen?
It's rumored that that Suge Knight brought a hypodermic. It's not true.
Definitely.
It's not, but that's a rumor, though.
Nah, man. Yo, I will say this about this whole story. If you want to get deep into the conspiracy theory surrounding the death of Biggie and Tupac,
right.
It is deep and it is long. And everyone's done it. And everyone's still alive.
It's amazing how deep conspiracy theories can go, you know, because it's all people making things up. And then you can just do that forever. You can, like, make – that's the thing with conspiracy theories. There's a lot of data, very little truth. Interesting, though.
Well, the thing is about the Jake Robles murder, Suge Knight fully believed that the person who gave the order to shoot was Sean Puffy Combs.
Okay.
Now, as we said at the top of the last episode, the Biggie and Tupac murders are essentially solved cold cases, meaning investigators know who did it and know who was responsible, but were never able to gather enough evidence to prove it in a court of law.
It's so interesting, though, because wasn't Puffy's brand, like, the nice one? Wasn't he considered, like, the nicer
now
rapper?
Now it is.
But wasn't
now
that back? I don't remember. I just remember him with Mace and who became a preacher. Like, I never remembered Puffy being tough, but...
Because this was the first chapter of the rap that got to us, okay?
Right.
Where it's like when we really absorbed Puffy, it was him doing the shoulder dance and like the white silver shoot and the mirror tunnel and all that shit. But before that, he was hardcore.
Okay.
And especially because of Suge, he had to present himself as even more hardcore than he wanted to because Suge actually meant violence.
Right.
He was surrounding himself with Cruz because he came from the MOB. Like, he was actually fully involved with the Bloods, and Puffy had to figure out how to compete beat, and also for marketing's sake,
yeah,
he had to appear very, very tough.
Right. Well, I mean, he definitely gives more depth to his character, because you know now he's like, I'm sure he's had some meetings where it's like, you think I'm the guy from the reality show. Let me tell you a little story about Puff Daddy. And then I'm sure he gets very, very horrified at that point.
Now, the thing is about this case is the reason why there was never enough evidence to prove it in a court of law, because, of course, when it comes to criminal cases, there's what you know and what you can prove.
Right.
And those are two very different things.
Yes.
And the reason why it never came to court was because there was no follow through.
Hmm.
And that's also why the vast majority of people still believe that these murders are such a huge mystery.
Right.
And so because of that, we've got three stories to tell: the murders, the investigation, and why that follow through didn't happen.
All right.
Now, the investigation that cracked things wide open was not the original. The original Biggie investigation was headed up partly by a decorated officer named Russell Poole, who, while being a fantastic cop and very good at his job, he unfortunately lost the plot when he became convinced the murder was a wide-reaching conspiracy involving the LAPD.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of like when Philip K. Dick went insane, right? When he went insane because of his brain tumor. He had an aneurysm, and he went nuts. He went insane in the coolest way possible, because he was a brilliant sci-fi writer,
right?
And he went down to the depths of his own mind, and he was using his brilliant fictional brain to try to figure out what was happening to him in reality. Mm. And it created the Vallis trilogy, which is obvious for me, the peak of sci-fi, right? I fucking love it. Russell Poole was
I'm
such
so
a
happy
good cop.
You somehow got to Philip K. Dick in our Biggie and Tupac series. Congratulations.
I have to.
That is
I
a nerd leap. That is wow.
I have to bring it back to a way I can understand. But Russell Poole is like that. He was such a good cop.
Right.
He began to investigate himself.
That is.
It was he eventually, at right. some point, Russell Poole was like, maybe I did this.
Wow.
And I have to investigate this to see maybe if I did it. And he went all the way down, the picture of Charlie Day from Always Sunny with the fucking yarn lines,
yeah,
and the
right.
whole conspiracy thing. That was him. And Labyrinth is a good, his book that he wrote is good to see what it's like to see a man incept himself into police conspiracy, but it's also
right.
throws you off the track of what really happened with Biggie and Tupac.
I didn't realize. So a actual police officer was the first one to come up with this conspiracy that the
yes.
LAPD was involved. That's pretty fascinating. Usually yeah. it's someone who looks like Henry, who is just constantly outside the police department smoking near the bushes, and everyone's we can see the smoke billowing out of the bushes, Mr. Zabrowski. Can you please just leave?
Now I can't see me. That's what the smoke is there for. So I only see the smoke.
Sorry, sir. You have to leave. Yeah, but that's how bad the LAPD was at the time.
I
yeah.
see.
Was that they were so bad that cops within it were trying to frame the police department
right.
for crimes just yeah. to stop them.
Yeah, this is, this is just after the Rodney King riots and all that kind of stuff, right? This
About 6-7 years after that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're talking maybe 5 years after
okay.
that. But when the story really started coming up, that was late 90s.
Oh, right.
And actually, Poole, RIP, he just died, I think, last year.
Hmm.
He later came up with a different theory, but his original theory is partly and poorly laid out in the aforementioned Nick Broomfield documentary, Biggie and Tupac.
Okay.
The theory is, all conspiracy thought, complicated beyond comprehension.
Right.
Long story short, Poole followed the evidence to a point where a theory involving the LAP could be formulated, but once he got that theory stuck in his head, he tried to force the evidence to fit his narrative, ignoring
okay.
anything contradictory.
It's a great story, though.
It's a great
story. Which is the reason why he did it, and the coincidences in it are holy shit, you can't
right.
make this stuff up. But it was wrong. It was still just coincidences, which is obviously that the all thing about all conspiracy theories, that there's just enough
right.
to keep you going when it's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so instead of following the evidence and going where the evidence took him, he wanted to take the evidence where he wanted to put it.
Exactly,
okay.
yeah. And I've heard a cop say, there's no coincidence in homicide. The one story that really made me rethink the concept of coincidence is Mark David Chapman.
Sure.
When you look at how many coincidences came up in that story, it really does make you a believer. It's sometimes the world just creates roadblocks.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, the reason why, Henry said, the reason why they, Poole followed this story is because the story is so compelling. According to that, Biggie Smalls was murdered under the order of Suge Knight in retaliation for Tupac's death by an LAPD officer named David Mack in conjunction with a Nation of Islam member named Amir Muhammad.
Okay.
Now, David Mack is a crazy character to begin with, anyway, because that was a cop that was robbing fucking banks. It was like that whole Rampart story is nuts.
Yeah.
He was robbing banks as a cop?
He was robbing banks as a cop. He did, what was one of his heists, like $750,000?
Wow.
He was serious.
Because he used his cop smarts to realize when to go pick up the money from the bank, because you have to wait because the bank purges cash after a period of time. So you have to wait till it's at its peak and go get it like a butt.
Interesting. So he used his cop sense. He used his cop smarts. Very similar to pig sense. We talk about pig sense. Who was the guy who had pig sense?
Robert Picton.
Robert Picton's pig sense and this cop's.
You have the memory of a goldfish.
Thank you.
Is it the booze?
No. I swim a lot. No, I don't know. No. We cover so much.
We cover so much.
And honestly, goldfish, they have a 3-second memory, but what else? That's all they need. Yeah. Theoretically, it keeps them happy and alive in those little fish tanks.
So you're excited for dementia.
I honestly,
because you feel like that's
whatever.
When you'll finally be released. You'll finally be at ease.
Make them up.
So furthermore, David Mack was a cop that was a part of a broader contingent, according to Poole, within the LAPD that was on Suge Knight's payroll. So according to Russell Poole, like, there were a ton of cops that were on the death row payroll. And all of this was coming on the heels of a major LAPD corruption case involving the aforementioned anti-gang crash unit. That scandal was known as Rampart.
Okay.
And add to that just the general distrust and disdain people have for the LAPD due to very public incidents that usually involved race in some way or another, and suddenly, Poole's theory started to sound pretty reasonable.
Sure.
But it didn't sound reasonable to the LAPD.
Well, naturally, they're the ones who are accused of doing the crime. That's the least stunning piece of information I have ever heard in my entire life.
They were doubtful?
They were skeptical about his theory?
And so Poole was taken off the case.
Okay.
And this actually served the opposite purpose for the LAPD because this attracted more attention to Poole's theory, and it particularly attracted the attention of Biggie's mother, Valletta Wallace.
So this is your obstruction of justice case against the LAPD on Mr. Poole there.
Yeah. And so Valletta Wallace used the evidence Poole had gathered to bring a wrongful death suit against the LAPD, suing the department for Biggie's estimated lifetime earnings, which sat at a cool $500 million.
Woo!
Holy hell.
Yeah.
Wow.
Woo. And the LAPD did not want to fucking... They did not want to give up $500 million because that's a lot of Donkey Kong arcade games, which is what they have in a lot of the lunchrooms in police departments. Because that's what I remember from my father's police department. That's where I would go. They'd take your son to work day, and he just put me in the lunchroom, and I'd play Donkey Kong all day.
Wow. Well, what a life lesson that is.
Yep.
Well, needless to say, as soon as this $500 million lawsuit came through, the LAPD started paying attention.
I don't know if I like this idea of police officers taking their son to work day. Like, just imagine being a perp getting cuffed and then just like a little 7-year-old Henry Zabrowski be like,
"What'd you do? Was it murder?"
No, I'm not.
You ever think that maybe when you go to jail that someone's going to poke you in the back stairs?
God damn it. Can we just get this over with?
No, it's true. I got to shoot a gun.
You did?
Yeah, we went to the range. My dad had to qualify. It was like it worked at the same time. My dad had to go. He had to qualify because you have to qualify to get your license every year. And he had to qualify, and he took me to the range, and I shot a gun. And then we went to my favorite comic book store, The Web. I still remember that as being the favorite day of my childhood.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Well, after the LAPD started paying attention, that's when they assigned Detective Greg Kading to solve the case.
Okay.
Now, I misspoke a little bit last episode. Operation Wrap It Up was actually a subfile of the overall operation to catch Biggie's murderer, which was Operation Transparency.
Okay. All very cool names, I have to say. So far, Rampart? It's Operation Rampart?
No, Rampart was the name of the police station that was caught up in the scandal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and later made into a movie starring Woody Harrelson, which resulted in a weird Reddit thing.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, very good.
Now, as far as the public knew, Operation Transparency had one job: solve the murder of Biggie Smalls. Hmm. But really, the LAPD cared about something different altogether.
Uh-oh.
Cover our asses.
Oh, that's not transparency at all.
Yeah. Operation Overalls.
But in the process of trying to solve the Biggie Smalls murder, Kading ended up blowing the lid off everything, wow. Revealing a tale of treachery, hubris, and above all, careless disregard.
Oh. Which is another thing too, man. Greg Kading was also such a good cop, but also kept him from being a cop anymore. All these right. guys investigating the LAPD eventually quit because they were like, this place sucks.
Wow. All right. Interesting. So, yeah. So, he ended up not following through, huh? They didn't allow him to?
Well, we'll have to see how let's see how the story unfolds.
Yes, let's see how the story unfolds.
Well, first, Kading had to debunk Poole's theory, which was actually fairly easy to do.
Okay.
Poole had relied heavily on uncorroborated statements from jail informants who were quickly discredited, half the evidence didn't match up, and the sinister Nation of Islam member, Amir Muhammad, he was just a mortgage broker named Harry Billups, who just happened to be the accused LAPD cop's college roommate.
Okay. It is very, very sad.
Yeah.
So Harry Billups, known as Amir Muhammad, went to go visit David Mack in jail. And what happened was so he went there and they were hanging out and it was fine, a normal visit. But at some point, Russell Poole is just going through contacts. And the thing about jailhouse confessions is that they'll say anything.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Of course.
And so it was a guy's like, check it. I got news on the murder of Biggie Smalls. And Russell Poole's like, tell me all about it. I'm sorry, that's the Nick Broomfield voice, and so that's what I'll do. Tell me all about it. He's like, yeah, check it. And the thing is, you got to get me a TV, man. You got to get me a TV. He's like, okay, whatever you need, some Slim Jims. Yeah, some Slim Jims. Yeah, that'd be good too, man. Yeah. He's like, whatever it takes to crack the unsolved murder of Biggie Smalls. And then in truth, he said, yeah, I know the shooter. His name is, I think it's Aman? Amir? Mahan? And he just named like three things that sort of sounded like Amir. And yeah. then when he came up showing that he visited David Mack, they're like, this is the guy. And then it ruined Harry Billups' life, yeah. who was just, wasn't he a mortgage broker?
He was a mortgage broker.
Oh, my God. He might as well have just talked to you when it was bring your son to work day. Good Lord.
I did the crime.
That is unbelievably sad, though, that yeah. this random dude just got pulled into this thing unbeknownst to him entirely?
Entirely. It was all based on, like, he was just going to see his old buddy.
Jeez.
And after that, like, Poole just ran with it. And, yeah, Billups did come out and say, like, this whole thing has ruined my life completely. I think there was a lawsuit involved.
I hope he got some money.
Yeah, I think he got a little bit.
Okay.
So even though very little of the original murder investigation was actually useful to Kading, the task force was not starting from square one. They also had access to a federal racketeering investigation against Death Row, which had ran from 1995 to 2001.
Wow.
Unfortunately, though, like hundreds of other FBI cases, the Death Row case was scuttled following the events of September 11th and was completely abandoned.
Hold on, Marcus. You're telling me it was scuttled?
Yeah. It was scuttled like a bunch of crabs.
Wow.
Because that's what crabs do. That's what a crab movement in a group is called, a scuttle.
I didn't realize that.
Uh-huh.
I learned something new every day that I will quickly forget. So 9/11, actually, in a strange way, obviously that was the biggest crime in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So that actually kind of saved their ass.
It saved hundreds of people's asses because when all of these investigations that were going on in the FBI, as soon as 9/11 happened, all of their resources got reallocated. So all of these criminals who had been sweating bullets were very thankful for September 11th.
A good thing to remember about this investigation is that most of this is happening 10 years after the fact.
Yeah.
Right, like 9, 10 years. So also remember, they're piecing all of this shit together afterwards, where it's like every single time Greg Kading's pulling out another file, because it's very interesting. Because of the implications of Russell Poole, which you'll find out in Murder Rap, all of the files that were put together as the investigation that Russell Poole did, like four huge binders of information about these, were given to the Internal Affairs. Internal Affairs held on to this shit, and Greg Kading had to wait for them to photocopy this shit. So it took months of him pulling out this stuff bit after bit, and he gets the next file, and he's like, holy shit, they've been investigating them for racketeering for 6 years? And he didn't know.
Could have used that information before.
Actually, I don't think it was four. I think it was 72 gigantic binders. Wow. Like, it was a, they showed a picture of all of the boxes that these things were in, and it was just a gigantic, gigantic process.
Okay.
Now, because of the slow pace of the investigation, because he was only getting a few things at a time, it took Kading and his team 2 years to get their first real break. And that break came in the form of a man named Dwayne Keith Davis, a.k.a. Keefy D, described by one informant as the president of the Southside Crips. Now, Keefy was actually a major player, being one of the people responsible for taking the Crips from a Los Angeles local to the nationwide criminal enterprise with chapters in every American city that it eventually became. But the reason why Kading wanted to talk to Keefy was because Keefy was one of only a handful of people that were present at both the murder of Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls.
Keefy is the Vince McMahon of the Crips. He brought it full nationwide.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely took over a lot of areas, perhaps angered a lot of people while doing it. Vince McMahon, by the way, he is muscle milk come to life. That is what that man is.
He is a lot of veins.
Yes.
And vocal cords. That's really all he is. I see, for Keefy D, the first thing I thought was a Suzanne Somers.
What do you
and
mean?
He, it was like the Crips were his thigh master, and he gave it all over the world.
Okay.
Again, I'm bringing it to things I understand.
Yeah,
no, I just was thinking about the thigh master for some reason. As
that
well.
Thigh master, my mother had one. It was very difficult.
Oh yeah.
And I was trying to do it as a child, a very overweight child, and it sprung up and it hit me in the face. That was horrible. I never did that again.
Well, all Kading needed was a way to make Keefy talk, and he did that with a gallon of liquid PCP.
Get out
of
here.
A lot of people will talk if you do a gallon of PCP.
Wait, is this, what do you, is, this guy is a police officer with the LAPD, right?
Well, working in conjunction with the DEA, Kading used an informant named Dirt Rock to set up a fake buy. Now, the deal went off without a hitch, but a few days later, Kading, flanked with DEA agents, showed up at Keefy's house and laid out all the evidence they had on the deal, which was enough to put away Keefy for life.
I have a question for our listeners. Can someone tell me, if you have casually used PCP, why?
I don't think you can.
And what does it do that's good? I want to know what's good, because they talk about a lot of these guys made their living selling PCP and weed, and it's like, I don't really understand the desire to do just PCP on its own. But I don't know if it's like, if you do it at low levels, is it fun?
I don't know. I dated a girl for a long time who had like a 2-year PCP habit before we got together, and she was never really able to fully explain to me. Like, I think she was just like, it stars.
Yeah, and it's brought out. It doesn't sound very fun. I watched one thing on the drug wars on maybe National Geographic, and they dip it in the cigarettes. That's usually how you take it.
Yeah,
and no one looked to be like super thrilled. They were naked, like pretty much immediately.
Yeah.
But they didn't look to be happy.
It's called getting wet.
Yeah, getting wet. Yeah, that's what this was for. Keefy D was buying the gallon of liquid PCP. It was like $10,500.
Yeah, a lot of PCP.
It was enough to put him away forever.
Wow.
But then they told Keefy there was actually a way out of all this. And when Keefy asked how, Kading said,
"Let me put it this way. We're homicide investigators." Wink, 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 wink.
Am I just extremely high on PCP, or are you winking like a bunch?
Wink, wink, wink. I'm saying wink, but I physically can't wink because I have to keep my eyes open all the time because I'm investigating the murder of Biggie Smalls. I should have just said that.
Well, get to it.
Well, actually, they left without telling him what murder it was they were actually investigating.
Okay.
They just left it hanging like, we're homicide investigators.
Right.
And then they left.
But so, I'm just going to... But there was just a gallon of PCP that the LAPD just kind of let loose.
The DEA.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they just let that go. They're
they
like,
got it back. They got it back
that's in small, petty arrest that was sort of ruined lives. Okay, all right, makes
come
a lot
on.
Of sense.
Come on, buddy.
Yeah, that's when people were like, there's no way the CIA introduced crack. This happens all the time. In this case, it was a gallon of PCP that they were just like, that's collateral damage in the murder of Biggie and Tupac.
Yeah, you could definitely see like Keefy D and Kading outside talking, and then his other buddy, like Swamp Thing, his friend, like with the big barrel of it, just being like, so I'm just going to take this and I'm going to hide this.
Well, less than an hour after Kading left, Keefy's attorney called and said Keefy was ready to talk.
And talk a lot. Because once again, he's not. No, I know. He's not high off PCP. He's selling the stuff.
Yeah, he's selling the stuff. But Kading let Keefy sweat for like a month. Like, they didn't come back for a while because they wanted him to wonder, like, which murder is it that they want to talk about?
Sure,
like, what
yeah.
What is this? Gosh. What's going to be going on?
You know you have an interesting life when you're like, oh, I know they're homicide detectives, and then you have to do a mental Rolodex of everyone.
Which one? Hmm. Which murder could it be? Have I murdered? Like, when you have to sit there and be like, I don't even know if I've murdered. Oh, man.
Internal wink, 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 wink.
And then, at their next meeting, Kading revealed the focus of his investigation, Biggie Smalls. To this, Keefe said he didn't know anything about that murder, but what he did know, in Keefe's words, was gonna blow Kading's fucking mind.
All right.
And when Keating asked him to elaborate, Keefe said, that one wasn't us.
Oh. And he was like, what?
Yeah.
You're fucking with me, dude.
I just picture him giving back the gallon of PCP to Caden, just similar to the Naked Gun when he's bribing the guy and the guy is bribing him back.
Oh, yes, yes, back and forth.
And so, in trying to solve the Biggie case, Kading accidentally found a new lead in the long-since-abandoned case of Tupac Shakur.
Jeez.
Because that's the thing. The Las Vegas PD had done little to no investigative work on Tupac's murder.
Which is just crazy to me. This is like such a... It was such a huge case, and for them to just be like, we're sitting this one out. I never understood that.
It is the thing that we've seen again and again. It is a... It's the constant... Their thought process is that these guys were going to kill each other anyway. What do we give a shit?
Yeah.
They believe that these were gangster on gangster crimes, so they're like doing their job for them. So these men all died.
Yep.
Who had families and had a life and were just fucking artists. These guys were just artists.
Right.
They were dabbling in the life, but they were just guys making music, and they got murdered and no one gave a shit.
Yeah, we can't lose sight of that. These are artists here.
Yeah.
My sister is the best gift giver I've ever met of any person. It's Jackie Zabrowski. She shops all year thinking about her family and friends and puts little things aside for their birthdays and Christmases. I have no idea how she does it. I don't know how she do it. But guess what? She always wins Mother's Day, but not this year. I'm coming back. Ready to win Mother's Day and cement your reputation as the best gift giver in the family? I'm taking the crown. All right, give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. I mean this. We have the Aura frame up in my home. We absolutely love it. I can put photos on it very, very easily through the app. It's fun to do. And the memories keep cycling and I get emotional. And we filled it with pictures of Carmi and Wendy. And that is not sad. That is celebratory. So you should try it. It's honestly a really good product. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code LEFT at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It says here I have to talk about something I need to get off my chest, and I guess I can share it here. I eat mayonnaise for fun. It's a hobby of mine, and it's an addiction. And it's a daily weight on my life. How much I need whipped egg whites and oil crammed into my veins as soon as I wake up. And a lot of people carry around a lot of different stressors, big and small. Some people are presidents. Some people are soldiers. Some people have to eat mayonnaise, especially with hard-boiled eggs, which is what I eat for lunch. But I guess I should share that in therapy, because therapy is a safe place to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. And what I do is I just add eggs if I have mayonnaise left over. I just continue to add the eggs. But if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I hope they can help me. My God. I hope they can help me. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/lastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp. HELP.com/lastpod. This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Finding work-life balance can be tough, but Squarespace gives you the tools to reach your goals and have time to celebrate. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. With the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint, You can select from curated layout and styling options to create a personalized website optimized for every device. Get your website discovered fast with integrated, optimized SEO tools. Plus, make checkout easy for customers with easy-to-use payment tools. And with Squarespace AI, you can explain what your site is about, choose your tone, enter what you need, and get auto-generated text. And that helps you save time. I know I'm sitting on about 2 literal wheelbarrows filled with horse pics. Now, part of the issue has been is a lot of these pictures are getting stopped at customs because some of them do depict various world leaders in horse-like circumstances that seems to be pinging a lot of these custom agents' accounts. Now, so what I've done to do is like, so while I'm trying to work on hand smuggling these horse pics over various country borders, I then also have time, because Squarespace is doing all the other ad work for me, to go and work on my killdozer at home. So thank you, Squarespace, for allowing me to diversify in the best way possible for this country. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial when you're ready to launch. Go to squarespace.com/left to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. 1 in 5 Americans have learned a new language on their bucket list. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off the list with Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors. It's a waste. Don't waste hours on apps. Besides appetizers, that's the kind of apps I like. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Did you know that empanada is already Spanish? I didn't. Thanks, Babbel. Did you know that burrito is already Spanish? Wow! I just got to learn all the rest. And eventually, I'm going to be eating downtown Mexico. Thanks, Babbel. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at Babbel.com/left. Get up to 60% off at Babbel.com/left, spelled Babbel.com/left. Rules and restrictions may apply.
And the Las Vegas Police Department, they blamed their lack of investigation on the fact that key witnesses were uncooperative, because they were. Suge Knight even said, like just a few years ago, he said, yeah, I'm not paid to solve homicides, so I'm not talking to him. Yeah,
but street code, you do not snitch.
Yeah, I know that, but if you're a cop and you're investigating a murder and then everyone's like, not going to talk, like they're just like, okie dokie, we're just going to go on. And it's like, aren't you supposed to like do something to get him to talk or find a way?
Well, the truth of the matter is that it seemed like the Las Vegas Police Department never really gave a fuck about solving the murder in the first place.
Oh, right.
But Kading sure as hell gave a fuck, so he listened to Keefe's story. Now, this wasn't the first time Keefe had spoken to investigators. Years before, Keefe had claimed that he didn't have anything to do with Tupac's murder. He even pushed like a different theory altogether. Mm. He pushed another cop theory, but it was a slightly different one than Poole had put forth.
Okay.
Keefe had suggested that while it was still Compton police that pulled the trigger on Tupac, it was actually Suge who ordered the hit.
This is the dumbest theory of all of them.
This is the dumbest one? I thought that Suge...
This is the dumbest theory. Because a part of street code is, right, is that not only they don't snitch, but they'll just lie. They'll just say shit just to throw you off, which makes everything very, very difficult to piece together. But the idea was, is that Suge was afraid that Tupac was going to leave. Because the truth is that Tupac was trying to formulate his own little company. But he was, the whole point was that him and his managers and his lawyers, they were going to try to extricate him from the death row contract, because it was kind of like a weird little memo, friendly style with Suge, kind of the way that they worked it out with Easy and Dr. Dre, where they figured out how, like, Eazy-E will always get paid no matter what. So essentially, you massage it, so we'll separate, but the money will still go back to you. So what they said is that Suge found out and he flipped out. So he ordered a hit against Tupac that would happen while Suge was in the car, and that he would get men that were just trained enough that they could shoot Tupac while driving past without hitting him.
Well, you know, he's a big guy. He wears a lot of red. You know where not to shoot. I don't know.
I suppose so. But yeah, this is, also, I mean, this is common sense tells you there are such easier ways for if Suge was going to actually order a hit on Tupac, yeah. There are so much simpler ways than to have guys fire 13 shots into a car that you're sitting in.
It's a smart move, though. Why would I order the hit if I'm in the car? That's genius.
You get shot. But that's a part of what happened. But I will say, I watched a very revealing documentary that was released a couple of months ago called Who Shot Biggie and Tupac with Ice-T and Soledad O'Brien.
Oh, yeah.
And they shot a bunch of mannequins. Because the whole point was to show that how stupid the theory was. So they had a marksman shoot bad. Because they talked about how, like, well, obviously you'd have to be, like, the first thing he did was, like, you know, any angle that you hold your Glock. And the guy was, like, trying to shoot like a gangster. To, like, doing the sideways thing, just shooting at him and shooting at him, and then the whole time, like, you know, it's like the one gangster dude who was one of part of Tupac's detail was like, man, pulled up as Nina, and Soledad O'Brien was like, and what tail is a Nina? And Ice-T's like, a Nina's a nine, there's a gun. And then they slapped hands to each other, because that's all Ice-T did for the most of the documentary, was explain gang terms to Soledad O'Brien and look grimly on.
That's great. It's like what Key is doing in those commercials now, where he explains different kind of language to different generations.
So even though Keefe had said that whole Suge Knight hired the fucking cops to kill Tupac because of disloyalty, even though he'd said all that years ago, he was now claiming that that whole story was bullshit.
Mm.
And what follows now is the story of the murder of Tupac, with Keefe D filling in the blanks.
Okay.
So Keefe D came onto the Bad Boy record scene in the summer of 1995 when Biggie Smalls was touring as the headliner for the annual Summer Jam concert series. Mm. According to Keefe, Puffy hired a group of Crips to work security for the Anaheim and San Diego shows, paying them in free concert tickets.
Kind of your Rolling Stone Hell's Angels moment.
Well, that's it. That's the whole thing, man. I mean, it's not like Puffy couldn't afford to hire real security, just like the Rolling Stones didn't have to hire the Hell's Angels.
Right.
Angels for security at Altamont in exchange for $500 worth of beer. It just made him.
Although, I mean,
it just made him feel cool.
Right.
But there were a couple of things here. Number one, which I thought was really interesting, it was customary for East Coast rappers to have to pay a tribute to various LA gangs when you came into town. So a lot of what people said, eventually people were trying to avoid even coming to LA because you have to pay $30,000 just to play for the Crip. Basically, a gang would be like, this is our security fee. It's $30,000. We'll make sure everything's okay. We'll make sure people are safe. And he's just like, well, sir, I think we have our own security deal here. Thank you so much for the offer. He's like, well, how about just $30,000 so we don't fuck your shit up?
Yeah. Right.
Like that would happen. And then also, one thing Puff Daddy did do is that because of the burgeoning conflict between him and Suge, he hired and spoke to a section of the Crips that were specifically against the MOB Pyru crew. That was like a thing that caused a little bit of friction.
It's hard to understand all the factions here. It reminds me of the WCW NWO, the white NWO, and the red NWO, or the black and white NWO, and the red and black NWO. And I was really disappointed when Sting went over to the black NWO, but then he actually went over to the red NWO. But he should have just stayed with WCW.
Gotcha.
Anyway.
Don't understand. It is just as complicated because I don't understand. The gang hierarchy and structure is very, very intense. And one day we'll do Bloods and Crips because it's a fascinating story that has, like, it goes back to the fucking 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
Now, just like hiring the Hells Angels at Altamont resulted in the death of fan Meredith Hunter, Puffy's hiring of the Crips would have consequences that were even more far-reaching than that. Mm. See, the thing was, even though the Stones hired the Hells Angels, they weren't claiming to be Hells Angels.
Right, right.
Like, actually, they didn't even really know who the Hells Angels really were.
Yeah, I don't think, like, Mick Jagger's little bones rattling on a motorcycle, he would just fall apart.
Don't do this.
I'll tell you, this is worse than a carriage going down downtown London.
Like, yeah. So.
Yeah, the Stones were confusing the American Hells Angels with a bunch of British biker enthusiast posers who just called themselves the Hells Angels, who had worked security at a concert in Hyde Park in London the year before.
Do your due diligence.
Yeah.
That is what this means. Research what you're getting yourself involved in.
That's it. So they were used to drinking O'Doul's, and then they switched over to a huge keg of what's the worst? Ice House.
Ice House. Yeah.
Yes. Ice House is brutal.
Yeah. They didn't. The Rolling Stones did not know like how dangerous the Hell's Angels in America actually were. I mean, like Jefferson Airplane had used them for security once. And they said, "Oh, it went off without a hitch."
Okay.
But Altamont is also another one that we may do a story on, or at the very least, like concert disasters at large, because it's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
But still, like the Rolling Stones, like they were just trying to be cool. They didn't really know who they were dealing with.
Can we put Woodstock 99 and that Great White Fire in there?
We will.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
But Puffy, he knew exactly who he was hiring, and he knew exactly what hiring these guys meant. Hiring them meant he was unofficially aligning himself with the gang, with the Crips.
This is the making the band Puff Daddy.
Yeah.
it's really crazy.
Yes.
And this was done in response to something Suge Knight had said. A couple of weeks earlier, Suge Knight had very publicly called out Puffy at the 1995 Source Awards while accepting the award for Best Motion Picture Soundtrack for Above the Rim.
Remember that?
Mm-hmm. But when Suge went up to accept the award, he did so with someone on his mind, Tupac Shakur. Because earlier that day, Suge had been in upstate New York visiting Tupac in prison. So Suge started his speech by pledging his support to Tupac. But remember, Tupac had been telling Suge from day one that Biggie and Puffy were behind the shooting at Quad City that had occurred the day before Tupac had been sentenced.
Right.
That could be why Suge said this.
And one other thing I'd like to say, any artist out there want to be an artist and want to stay a star, don't want to have to worry about the executive producer trying to be all in the video, all on the record, dancing. Come to Death Row.
That was a lot like when Robert De Niro had his bold stance against President Donald. But I remember that. That was like crazy. Wasn't there a riot after that? Didn't that break out?
No.
No, that wasn't that.
Well, people freaked out in the audience because people started going nuts. Man, Suge's so big.
He's so big. That made it all the way to Stevens Point, Wisconsin, that speech. And we're like, that's really interesting. That's really cool. Yeah. Yeah. And then again, I'm like, they're probably still friends.
Yeah. Admittedly, Suge Knight was not wrong on this. I mean, Puffy did indeed insert himself into everything.
Every video.
Annoyingly so. But Suge said this not just in front of the entire hip-hop community, but in New York City on Puffy's home turf.
Uh-oh.
Which is also what got Tupac Shakur harassed in the first place by Haitian Jack, because you're talking mess in the other guy's territory. Like, you don't do that shit. Like, Haitian Jack, who is still alive.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, he's still alive, and he says he had nothing to do with it. But the guy who did it called him and said, I did this without your permission. And he was just like, no, why did you do this?
So bad.
All right.
Now, Suge hadn't threatened any violence here, but he had a way about him where he didn't really need to.
No.
To put it simply, Suge had a reputation, and that reputation scared the ever-loving shit out of Puffy. See, Death Row had long since allied themselves completely with the Bloods, despite Snoop Dogg's previous connection to the Crips. And the Bloods, specifically the Mob Piru, acted as Suge Knight's enforcers. And that's a big reason why Puffy decided to hire the Crips to act as their personal security at the Summer Jam's California dates.
If Suge Knight was a character on Pee-wee Herman's Playhouse, he would just be the refrigerator, and every time you open it up, he's like, I'm going to kill you. And then you have to shut it immediately. He was huge. He was like... Such a big... His shoulders are the big... Anthony Mason of the New York Knicks, RIP Anthony, he and Suge have the same size shoulders, and they were the biggest... Anthony's were the biggest I've ever seen in my life. I passed him on the street.
Suge Knight was an NFL defensive end.
Yeah, huge.
A gigantic man. And with this, the East Coast-West Coast rivalry now had actual gang affiliations. Ooh. Right in the middle of the bloodiest gang war this country had seen since Prohibition.
Wow.
But these guys are playing with fire, of course, right? Obviously, they're playing with fire. But the connections are... Remember when we say all these things, and a lot of people will read these in books, too, and talk about like them being really connected to these gangs. The gang connection's really nebulous. It's more like they invited them into their house like a vampire. Like, they invited them in to being like, we're going to make you a part of our scene. And the problem is that when you have a bunch of people that are really, truly criminals, these people are actually uncontrollable.
Right.
You're just now letting chaos go. And these guys are going to mix how they're going to mix. And now you act like you think that you can control them,
right,
which is we're going to find out is the biggest problem of all.
So this, would you say this is the biggest mistake? The actual aligning themselves with these very legitimate people? Did Suge know? I mean, he had to know how serious these guys are, right? Like, Suge.
Well, Suge was something completely, like, because that's the thing is that Suge was, he was serious. Suge was was an actual, like, he was a criminal. Like, he knew exactly what he was doing. He had come up more in that world, and he was good at it.
Right.
Puffy, on the other hand, was not quite the same type of person.
No, Puffy,
like,
was
Puffy
on
with- was he was but I mean, because really, yeah, I mean, you say, like, you know, Puffy was the nicer one. Like,
he was on TLC, what's the name of it? Total Request Live. He was on TRL with Carson Daly.
Yeah, I mean, he co-hosted Regis and Kelly. He was the guy that brought hip hop into the mainstream.
Yeah,
like,
well,
he was the one that did.
He was the nice one that the Midwest could digest.
He
right?
was. He was the one that he had the smooth style. Like, right. It wasn't any. It wasn't funky. You know. It was very smooth. So Puffy was. He was really playing with fire and had no idea what the fuck he was doing, or at least he thought he knew he did, but he did not.
Right. Right.
Now Puffy, after hiring the Crips, he started flexing a little. Just before Biggie's show in Anaheim, just a couple of weeks after the Source Awards diss, Puffy allegedly told a room full of Crips that he'd give anything for the head of Suge Knight. He just starts throwing this shit out there. Now, it doesn't really seem like Puffy was really serious with this threat at that point. But then the Jake Robles murder happened in Atlanta, and Suge publicly blamed Robles' death on one of Puffy's bodyguards. Now, Puffy completely denies having anything to do with the murder, even pointing out that he was standing right next to Suge Knight when it happened, because he was.
So Puffy is just acting like Prince Nottingham right now, just be like, bring me his head. A very serious request, I think.
It's way more similar to the Cousin Eddie moment from National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, where he took Chevy Chase
wrapped
in
a nice little bow.
He's like, all right. Like it is that.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, it didn't matter whether or not Puffy had anything to do with the murder of Jake Robles. All that mattered was that Suge believed Puffy was behind it.
Right.
And that murder was partly why Tupac released Hit 'Em Up on June 4th, 1996. Now, up until that point, hip-hop artists didn't really openly threaten each other with violence on diss tracks. And they certainly didn't threaten each other with murder.
Right.
Most of the time, like, it's like they'd... It'd be an attack on the other person's cred, maybe a few jokes about their appearance, followed by a couple of homophobic insults,
right,
and that'd be the end of it. But Hit 'Em Up was different. It was violent, specific, and very, very personal.
Hmm.
Before the beat even starts, Tupac just comes right out and says,
"That's why I fucked your bitch, you fat motherfucker."
Whoa.
That doesn't even rhyme.
Sign up for a roast. This is not what I'm supposed to be involved in. I've not prepared any material, so.
Yeah. Roast mode.
Like, yeah, it's just like, fuck. Yeah. Like that was right up top.
And that is, like, it's also very indicative of how huge Suge Knight was. Like, everyone was just like, must have been talking about Mr. Knight there. Because there's only one. Or
Biggie.
No, Biggie, rather. I'm sorry. That's indicative of how big Biggie was, yes.
Yeah. And Tupac saying, "I fucked your bitch," that was in reference to Biggie's wife, Faith Evans, who had collaborated with Tupac on a track the year before. And it only got more aggressive from there. Throughout the song, Tupac made it very clear that this was not just talk.
Isn't the music video, did we mention the music video? Isn't it just a big guy pretending to be Notorious B.I.G.
Yes,
and they just beat him up throughout the entire video?
Well, he just kind of looks like a fool, because that was pretty common in hip-hop videos as well. It's like, if you're talking shit about the guy, you usually hire a guy to look like the guy you're making fun of.
Right,
and then you kind of chase him around, and it's, you know, and it's actually most of the times pretty goofy.
Right.
Like, they did that with, I think, like, they had an Eazy-E impersonator for the Dre Day video.
Yeah, they got a little guy. They got a little guy to play Eazy-E, and then they chase him around like Benny Hill. Like, it's funny. It's like a silly little moment.
Yeah.
That's what they did with Bret Hart after the Montreal Screwjob on Monday Night Raw. They brought a little person to be Bret Hart. That's funny.
Well, this was completely different. This could not be taken in any way as lighthearted.
Okay.
It was aggressive. Now, throughout the song, Tupac made it very clear that this was not just talk. He even made sure to explicitly say this was not a rap battle. The plan is to kill you. And he called out Biggie, Puffy, and Bad Boy at Large by name. Hmm. Now, violence and gangster rap lyrics is not new. I mean, it's a big part of it. But usually, the violence had been broad and vague. It's more of like a generalized character building thing. With this, though, Tupac was making specific threats. He even devoted the last minute and a half of the song to just talking. And the more he talked, the angrier he got. Hmm. And eventually, he landed on this.
All of y'all motherfuckers, fuck you, die slow, motherfucker. My fofo makes sure all y'all kids don't grow. You motherfuckers.
Which was seen as pretty aggressive.
I think. I understand.
You know what
why.
I'll say? It's almost nice. Because him dying slow, he can say, like, goodbye to his family.
Sure.
He has, like, a couple of last moments. He could throw out one last final rap.
Yeah.
To everyone. So it's great. It's nice, actually.
Yeah, if he was, like, the witch from the movie Thinner, where he was just, like, he just cursed him, and it took about 3 months before he inevitably evaporated into the earth. But obviously that's not what happened.
Yeah, and that's only a small part of that ending rant. But this also begs a question. How serious was Tupac?
How serious was Tupac?
Was he really going to kill anyone?
Was he really going to kill anyone?
Or
very good.
Was this just the next logical lyrical evolution in the game that these dudes were playing?
That's a long question. That's too long of a question for me to repeat.
Well, Tupac got real serious. And they were like, his whole crew, him and the Outlaws, were very, very serious. They were threatening violence quite a bit. They were all carrying Ninas. Everybody was ready to go. They were ready to, like, he was, and to the point where Snoop Dogg was afraid of him. That whole story where they took the plane over and, like, Snoop Dogg had accidentally hung out with a bunch of East Coast guys.
Yeah.
And Tupac found out and he was furious. And so Snoop Dogg had to hide under a blanket with a fork and knife that he was waiting for Tupac to come get him in his sleep.
Yeah.
God, but I love Snoop. I'm so happy that Snoop is still with us.
I'm so happy.
His YouTube channel is absolutely hilarious.
Yeah,
anyway.
I mean, they'd taken it even further than that because they were on a private jet from New York to L.A., and they took Snoop Dogg's security away from him. They're like, no, they're not going with you. You're going on this plane right now. You're coming with us.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, he sat there just hiding with a knife and fork, just waiting for someone to attack him.
All right.
But you just really have to wonder, like.
I also do think. I just picture Chris Christie during Bridgegate doing the exact same thing. Just like contouring with a knife and fork. But these are the only weapons I know how to use.
Also, I feel maybe if I just hold the knife and fork, the meatball will show up.
Gotcha, Chris Christie. Piece of shit.
I mean, and there were other, like, smaller, like, specific, like, West Coast over the East Coast diss tracks, like the Dog Pound did a video in which, and there was like a bit of gunfire exchange there. Like the Dog Pound came to New York to shoot a video, and it was called New York, New York, and it was supposed to be more of a tribute to New York, like mm-hmm. it was respectful. But they were shooting a part of the video in Red Hook in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. And shots rang out. Someone took some shots at him, and so what they ended up doing is coming back to Los Angeles and doing it all on green screen. Where the Dog Pound, including Snoop Dogg, were all gigantic Godzillas, and they were like knocking down all the buildings in New York City.
That's a fun idea.
That's cute.
It's a great song, and it's a really fun video.
Right.
But you know, Hit 'Em Up took that further. Like right. That took it up to the next level.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, they're just pretending like they're the monsters from the Rampage, the video game.
Yeah,
and then Tupac actually is just. It's going
fun.
Into great detail about how he's going to kill Biggie.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And because of that, you know, according to Keefe D, like, Puffy wasn't going to take the chance that Tupac was serious or not. Or at least, he didn't want to appear to take that chance. See, besides just being the facilitator of the Crips hire, Keefe D and Puffy were friends. They were introduced by a New York drug dealer named Zip, who owned a nightclub in Harlem called the Zip Code.
Cool. I love
it. It does sound like he's selling. Hey guys, name Zip. Good to meet you. How's everybody doing today? This is my buddy, the Hound Dog.
A little Morning Zoo style.
But Keefe D was an L.A. guy, and just about every time Puffy went to L.A., the two met at lunch at Greenblatt's Diner over near the Laugh Factory on Sunset Boulevard. But as the years went by, their conversations became more and more dominated by the East Coast-West Coast rivalry.
Ugh.
And after Hit 'Em Up was released, complete with a music video to make sure it got attention,
right.
The conversation got serious, and Keefe D said that Puffy explicitly offered him $1 million to kill Suge Knight and Tupac Shakur.
Is he Dr. Evil?
Yes. $1 million. Oh, I miss it. I miss Vernon Troyer.
Oh, no. R.I.P.
But so tiny. But it's the Keefe D had to keep a straight face. Because they were talking about how he's like, when he's offering it, they're sitting having this serious, like, we got to kill him. I'll give you $1 million to kill Suge fucking Tupac Shakur. And he's like, I would have done it for like $50,000. Like, right. Just like, and she's just like holding, like waiting to see what if he follows up. And he's like, okay, I'll take $1 million.
Jeez, this is crazy. Yeah. All happening right outside the Laugh Factory. A place of joy and no sadness at all because it's a Laugh Factory.
Yeah.
Laugh Factory.
Laugh
Factory. So that laughs are pressed every 5 seconds by a man who's paid 45 cents an hour.
Now, there's speculation as to whether Puffy was serious here. Now, it could have just been more bravado, as in Puffy needed to look tough in front of his actual criminal friends and didn't actually expect Keefe D to kill Tupac and Suge.
I mean, they've been talking about it now. How long has this conversation been going on?
This conversation's been going on for a while, but it didn't really get... I mean, it's going on maybe two, three years.
At some point, don't you just have to stop and be like, we're just joking, right? Like, you got to bring it back to like, okay, but we're not being serious here.
There were guys that were trying to say that to him. They were like, what you'll find out too is that in this is that there are a lot of guys that were like, this is just, you guys understand, you guys are just kind of messing with this thing, but you're not real gangsters.
Yeah.
And they were far away from them.
Right.
The people that were their direct crew, like the Outlaws, made Tupac feel like he was fucking invincible. And Puff, surrounding himself with these Crips, also was making him like really, like they were playing a part, and it went too far. They were just sitting there, and it felt really good to sit and have like mafia conversations or at the fucking deli, like it's a Scorsese movie, and it's not.
Yeah, but none of those movies
feasible.
They never end well.
No,
Goodfellas has the most sad ending of maybe any movie of all time.
Whether Puffy was serious or not, Keefe D took him seriously, and so the word was out. Kill Tupac and Suge, make $1 million.
Oh, my God.
And here is where Tupac and Puffy were about to discover that while they may have been having a great time playing gangster, the guys they were surrounding themselves with were taking it very, very seriously. And that's where we'll pick up next time.
Right. Okay. Man, it's just so sad. Because I want to see Biggie now. I want to see him like talking about the new chicken shell taco at Taco Bell.
He would have died.
I want to see him promoting like a great restaurant. Like he would. Who knows what he would have been doing?
He would have been the colonel.
Yeah, he would just be like. Oh my god.
He was not. And even when he died, he was only. See, I remember these dudes.
I know they're so
young. The one thing that we always forget when talking about these stories, these guys were 24 and 25 years old.
Yep.
That's it.
They only seemed old to us because we were 14.
Yeah.
And I was like, 10 years difference. Oh, you know.
Yeah. They were
just
young.
So sad.
Biggie Smalls was 24 years old. Tupac Shakur was 25 years old.
Yeah,
these guys were so young.
They were young.
Fucking kids. They didn't know what they were doing. They weren't paying attention.
Saying,
like,
sad.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, I hope nobody is thinking that we're like blaming these guys for their deaths or saying that, you know, it was or anything like that. We're absolutely not doing that.
No.
What we're saying is like these. Pay attention.
These
like, you
got
to pay attention to what's going on around you.
Be careful. We said this last episode. You have to be careful who you pretend to be.
Yeah.
Because you get exactly what you ask for in this life. This shit shows up. If you want to dabble in this kind of energy, you're going to have to pay for it eventually. This is just how it is. Like, no one gets away scot-free unless you're Haitian Jack. And you move to the Dominican Republic, and he seems to be fine. He's doing really good.
My goodness.
But man, oh, man.
Yes.
I'm just glad that Tupac's still alive.
Yeah,
after
that's
all
a good
of
point.
This shit.
That's a good point. And, you know, as we've said before, you know, surround yourself with good people. But if you are doing stuff wrong, you can always change, too.
Yeah.
It's never too late to change bad habits and just because they should just be alive.
Yeah.
But anywho. Yeah. All right. Well, very interesting. You know what? There's a lot to this story.
Yeah.
I'm just
there is
say
a lot.
That.
There's a lot to unpack. There's quite a bit. And we got one more part of it.
Yeah.
So I hope you guys enjoy our conclusion. because we've solved it. You're welcome.
We solved it by reading the book of the guy who solved it.
Right. Yeah,
also, yeah. But again, remember, people who did the outlaw, like, bought the book that we, the last book, Murder Rap is also a great book by Greg Kading, but it's very complicated.
Yeah, Murder Rap is great, and the documentary based on Murder Rap is also really great. But yes, Murder Rap is very complicated, and we might get into some of the complicated, like, how he really put this case together, because while Poole's theory is complicated in its players, Kading's theory is very simple in its players, but it is very complicated as to how he got the case to where it needed to be.
Right.
Because it's very complicated police work. But if you're interested in like police work and like police procedure, like Murder Rap is absolutely a great way to go. And Kading's a good writer too.
Awesome.
Like, not all that, you don't always get that with these books. Like sometimes these guys are not
Former detectives aren't always great writers.
Former detectives don't always make the best authors, but sometimes they're naturals. Sometimes they're great at it, and Greg Kading's one of those guys. So yeah, definitely awesome. support Greg Kading and support everyone.
I want to give a special shout out and a thank you to Daniela Panetta. She mentions us in her Hollywood Reporter episode or article. She's in the Jurassic World, The Fallen Kingdom.
Oh.
So go support our friend there. She was very kind. She said she's going to give a big chunk of her check to our Patreon, which is like unbelievably sweet. So thank you for the shout out. That was really nice.
So wait a second. I want to give one shout out.
All right.
To Greg Rushen, who bought me a bullwhip.
Oh my God.
That I
this
now
have.
This is
the last thing you need. Can I do an anti shout out? Why do you, Mr. Rushen, do you have any idea what you've done? You do
look
not need
this,
a cattle whip.
I'm invincible now. I can wear it as a belt. I could wear it. I could go into airport with it. And then if anybody causes any mess, if anybody causes a fucking mess, there is nobody that is not too real to not be whipped. Because that is what I will do, man. I provide a whip.
All right. Woo! I do wish we lived in a place where the bullwhip was the only weapon that existed, because then fights and duels would be ended in a much, well, it was still violent, and it would still hurt, but
still
everyone would
well,
most likely live.
There'd be a lot more stranglings.
Yeah, there would be that. Yeah. That's very difficult. You can't do a drive-by strangling. That's not,
absolutely,
and a drive-by
a
whipping is just kind of fun.
Ow!
And you're just like, what the
hell? Yeah, yeah. Ow. There'd be a lot less eyes.
Yeah.
That's for certain.
Oh, yeah. That's
you'll pop your eye out on one of these for a second.
There's
and
some
I
problems.
Had it for about 15 minutes, and I almost whipped Jackie across the face with it, but it's fun as shit.
Mm-hmm.
Because it makes me so much more uncontrollable.
Henry, I will tell you from experience, be careful. You can hurt yourself very badly with that thing.
Woo!
No, not the way that he's handling it and violently swinging it around like he knows what he's doing. No damage will come to Henry whatsoever. Tune in next month for I Patch Henry Zabrowski. You're going to shoot your eye out, kid. All right, everyone. Well, thank you so much for listening. We love you. Thanks for giving to our Patreon.
Of course.
Our tour dates are out there now, so check those out. We can't wait to see everyone. What do we got? We got Phoenix coming up.
Yeah,
Philly.
Phoenix, Philly, Boston, San Diego. And also to clear up like a little bit of confusion as far as like the VIP tickets go on Ticketmaster, whoever it is, did a terrible job of actually telling you what you get with that.
Yes.
For the VIP thing, it's pretty much, you know, we're starting to do much bigger venues now, so, you know, everybody can see us. And with those bigger venues, like, we just don't have time to meet everybody.
Right.
But with the VIP meet and greet thing, you also get a limited edition tour poster signed
cool.
by us.
This tour, I love these posters. I'm getting it framed.
Uh-huh, because this is the Nothing But Trouble Tour 2018.
Hell yeah.
And so we're going to be sign posters and you also get a lanyard.
Who doesn't love a lanyard?
Lanyards are really important because you can collect them and they're fun and they make you feel, but you can feel like you always walk into a crime scene anytime you want. But
I can honestly, definitely tell you're the son of a detective because you love a lanyard. You love to just flash lanyards.
Lanyard.
You're like, I've never seen someone more confident when a lanyard goes around their neck.
But we're trying this VIP thing too. Like, it's a change for us too. We're trying it. So like, honestly, to tell us what you think about it, come and meet us, and we're gonna hang out. You know, we're trying something because we're using this tour to create money to create a bigger project for ourselves.
Right.
Because what we like here, and the one thing about Last Podcast and Left and Wait's always been, is that we don't have any fucking corporate overlords.
They hate
us. It's just us.
Yeah.
It's the three of us. We now have a company. We're paying other people's living wages. It's a thing that's happening, and a part of what we'd like to do is make make sure, like, if we want to do a project, we can fund it ourselves. So we don't have to compromise or talk to anybody about what we're making. And I think that's important. There's so many fucking middlemen now out there making money off of artists.
You know what I would
specifically
say we are? We are the Green Bay Packers of podcasts.
How does that work?
How?
Because they're owned by the fans.
Ah.
Everyone has stake in the Green Bay Packers, and they're all shareholders. So that's what we are as well.
But honestly, thank you guys for fucking going on this journey with us. Honestly, this is one of those where I'm still always in shock about this.
Me too.
And I think I'm not going to say it doesn't have to do with rituals I did back in the day when I was really involved in chaos magic, and now I don't do it as much because of how much chaos it causes in my life.
You are really going to a dark place here at the end.
Nobody.
That's a good place.
It's a good place.
Both of us had to put that down.
Yeah, because you guys were doing things that were disgusting with the paper and then the eating and then all that stuff. But we're not going to get into all. We don't have to relitigate chaos magic.
No, we really don't. But yeah, we both had to put that to bed for a little while.
Okay. Well, thank you all so much.
Yeah.
So we're excited to see you. You can find all of us on the social media. I've deactivated my Twitter if there's any confusion because it was getting so toxic. I'm just trying to go without for a little while and see how that works.
I'm a brave warrior in the muck. You can find me on Twitter at Henry Loves You and Matt Marcus Parks and the fucking
bullshit. I think it's
bullshit.
Almost more brave to break out of the system, though, sometimes, too.
Or you can
sometimes
do it like me.
Correct.
You can have it and just ignore it. And every once in a while, go post something if you feel like it.
You can also do it that way.
It does work like that. And you can follow us on Instagram at Dr. Fantasy, at Marcus Parks, at Ben Kissel, the number one, where Kissel has been very active. He's been doing a lot of videotape, and it's really nice. You can see chunks of his life because I don't see your life as much anymore, so it's nice to see.
I want to give a shout-out to the Urban Pioneers?
The Urban Pioneers,
They are a great band. Marcus is related to the lead fiddlest? Is that a term?
Fiddle player.
Fiddle player.
Yeah.
And fiddlest? I don't know, it's kind of a funny word.
Yeah.
But they are on a tour right now all across America. I think they are old school, so they're just driving all around. So if you get a chance, check out the Urban Pioneers. I storied them on my Instagram. They were like, they deserve huge crowds. They really do.
Check them out. Yep, Liz is my cousin. Just go, you can follow them on Instagram at Urban Pioneers. Listen to their music on Spotify. And yeah, they do something like 250 dates a year.
That's crazy.
So they'll be out there. But they're on a tour right now. I think they're currently going down the East Coast and then coming back over to Texas.
Yeah.
But yes, please check them out. And go listen to them. They're fucking great.
All right, everyone.
And also follow Last Podcast on the Left and all of the bullshits at LP on the Left.
There it is. Hail yourselves, everyone.
Hail Satan.
Elgin.
Magustalations.
Hail me. Help a boy feel strong, not fragile.
Oh,
I like it. It's a long catchphrase.
Help a boy feel strong, not fragile. Help a boy feel
really
strong,
fit on a bumper
not,
sticker,
fragile.
Not fragile.
All right.
This is Comedy Bang Bang, the podcast, the promo, and in 30 seconds, I'm going to tell you why you should check out the show. I, the host Scott Aukerman, have a lighthearted conversation with famous celebrities like Jon Hamm, Allison Williams, Phoebe Bridgers, Bob Odenkirk, just to name a few. Things go a little off the rails when different eccentric characters drop by to be interviewed as well. Each week is a blend of conversations and character work from your favorite comedians, as well as some new hilarious voices. Comedy Bang Bang, the podcast. Listen every Monday wherever you get your podcasts.
Emmy award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.